Good evening. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library. It's great to have you all here tonight. It's my pleasure to thank all of our loyal members for their ongoing support of the library. You probably noticed in the last few days that you got a letter in the mail from us. It's a time when we do ask for your support. The support that you provide does allow us to have great events, run a children's library, buy books, and do everything we do here at the library. So please help us out this fall. It's my pleasure now to welcome Ada Peluso, who's been a trustee of our library since 2009 and a very good friend to the library. And Ada will introduce our speaker.
Good evening. I must say that I'm so honored and pleased to have the opportunity to introduce tonight's guest speaker, the renowned Australian writer Peter Carey. He has published 12 novels, one work of juvenile fiction, four works of nonfiction, a large number of short stories, and two screenplays. From his internationally distinguished long list of awards and distinctions, I will mention the following. Mr. Carey is one of only two writers to have twice won the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. The prize assures international renown. Mr. Carey won his first Booker Prize in 1988 for Oscar and Lucinda. He won his second Booker Prize in 2001 for True History of the Kelly Gang. Mr. Carey is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, the senior literary organization in Britain. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, one of the oldest and most prestigious honorary societies in the United States. Election to the Academy is considered one of the nation's highest honors. In 2010, Mr. Carey appeared on two Australian postage stamps in a series dedicated to, quote, Australian legends, unquote. And I have the two stamps here if you want to see them at the end of the event. This past spring, he received the Bodley Medal, awarded by the Bodleian Libraries of the University of Oxford, to individuals who have made outstanding contributions to the worlds of literature, culture, science, and communication. Mr. Carey was named an Officer of the Order of Australia by Queen Elizabeth during her birthday honors this past June. The title was bestowed in recognition of his, quote, distinguished service to literature as a novelist through international promotion of the Australian identity, as a teacher, and as a mentor to emerging writers, end of quote. And there are also numerous other literary awards from various countries. Hunter College of the City University of New York has the distinction of having Mr. Carey as executive director of the Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program. In 4 years, he turned the program around. Mr. Carey has brought to the teaching faculty of this program such illustrious writers as Colm McCann and Nathan Englander in fiction, Louise DeSalvo, Catherine Harrison, and Mina Alexander in memoir writing, Tom Slay, Jan Heller-Levi, and Donna Massini in poetry. As a result, the program is considered the best in New York City and has become very competitive. Each year, 12 students are chosen from a couple of hundred applicants. Here are just a few of printed remarks made about Peter Carey's writing. Moving and witty at the same time, artful ability to capture a two-way interplay between past and present, one of today's best writers of literary historical fiction. What he does with words, the power and delicacy, the complex orchestration of color and theme seems impossible, more like music than language. And now we will hear from Peter Carey.
Well, it's all downhill from there. I'm allowed to have a cell phone. And that's because it has a stopwatch on it. So I don't go on and on. I'm going to start it. I'm going to try to do something rather dangerous and rather risky If it fails, I'm sorry. I'm going to try and talk about how a novel gets made, and I'm going to do it quite quickly because at the end I'm going to read to you for 18 minutes. So I'm going to talk about how two novels get made, and I'm going to try and do it in 5 minutes each. Let's see if I can. A long time ago, I wrote a novel which is called Oscar and Lucinda, about a relationship between an heiress and a rather neurotic young clergyman in Australia in the end of the 19th century. When I started, I had no idea of Oscar and no idea of Lucinda. And where I started, and this is what I want to talk about, the process of writing a novel. Where I started, I was living in a rural community in northern New South Wales, very pretty. And there was a lovely little clapboard church by a beautiful river, very simple, the river very beautiful, and a big escarpment, mountains. And every day I came into the valley, I was happy whenever I saw the church. And then one day I heard that the Bishop of Grafton was going to remove the church because there was not enough money in the plate, I suppose. And so they were going to take it away. Now, I have to tell you, I'm at the very least an agnostic, probably more fairly put, an atheist, but I grew up in the Christian church and the Christian faith, and I was astonished to find myself absolutely outraged that the Bishop of Grafton was going to take our church away. I couldn't believe that I felt so strongly about it. And so, being a novelist, my job is to think about myself all day long. So I thought, why did I feel like that? You know, was I still actually, even though I was pretending to be an atheist, was I really taking some Christian comfort from this landscape? And then I started to think, well, you know, if you're going to think about what, if I have a culture at all, it's really a Christian one. And actually, in fact, this atheist seems to write novels that are filled with all sorts of Christian symbolism, which is pointed out to me. The number of Marias in my books are quite phenomenal. And then I started to think about what it was that, how that church came into that landscape, which was filled with indigenous stories, all the stories of the people who'd lived there for successfully, let's say more or less for 50,000 years, which is not too bad, looking at today's societies and how long we're able to survive for. And really, the Christian society that came into that valley, that built the church there, supplanted the indigenous one. And as a result, and what you had to think of happening was that the church sort of passing, I imagined it floating on a river as a box of Christian stories floating through a landscape of indigenous stories where every rock and every place had a story attached to it. And I thought it was really significant that only after 200 years, as opposed to 50,000, after 200 years we no longer had any use for the church, which after all, in a sense, had justified all of that destruction. And now we were going to remove it. And because I lived on some land up the river and I knew what happens when the land is disturbed, I knew thistles would grow there. And that seemed to me about right for my country in terms of what we might believe, what were our faiths, our moral centres and so on. So I thought, this is very interesting. And so I went to my friend. I started to think, well, it's insane. So the writer has to think about the insane thing, because I had the symbol of the box full of Christian stories. And I thought, I'm going to have a raft. And I'm going to put a church on it, and I'm going to float it up the river. And that's insane, of course. And then I said, I was determined that I would do it. And in the end of the book, I have done it. But at the beginning of the book, I'm just interested in the symbolic power of this. And I'm thinking, it's ridiculous. But then I thought, well, maybe they did it for a bet. And then I remembered what Pascal had written about belief in God, saying that that was a bet. And that if you were right, well, you won and you got all of Christian paradise ahead of you. And if you were wrong, well, never mind, because you'd live quite a good life, and so you'd been a good person and so on. So I thought, there's a bet, there's something to do with gambling, and I started to look at the Bible in terms of the casting of lots, and I got interested in that. And then I talked to a friend who was an architect, and I said, how about, didn't the Victorians have sort of prefabricated buildings of some sort? I was thinking of the Crystal Palace, I suppose, and that's what he said back to me. Yes, for glass houses. And he said, why do you want to know? And I told him what I've just told you. And my friend said to me, well, why not have a glass church? And you see, and at that moment, I knew I had a book. And that's the moment. When you read the book, when you're reading the book, you're not, this is all the stuff that's under the hood. And it wouldn't occur to you that I had no interest in glass, that I didn't grow up in a vicarage, or that my family weren't in the glass business, or they will think I must have wanted to take holy orders. Well, no, or that I'd always been totally fascinated by glass. Well, no, but this is what the adventure of writing a book is, and this is why it's the most lovely way to live your life. It's awful too, but when it's good because you're going so far beyond what you know on a sort of a big exploration. And all I have to know at the beginning is this an interesting site of inquiry? Could I be interested in these things for 3 years? And yes, so have I done? Hang on. I'm going to let you know. I'm going to keep you up to date on this. 6 minutes, 56. Bit long. So then I wanted to talk about this new book, The Chemistry of Tears, which occurred to me today in an appalling way, which I'm not really very pleased about. It has some similarities with Oscar and Lucinda, and I'd really like to think every book's different, so I don't like that there'd be similarities. So in this particular book, this is also under the hood. So when you're reading it, I don't think you're going to see this particular. Where I started was really thinking about the internal combustion engine. And my father and my grandfather sold cars, and Henry Ford was God, until I bought my father a book about Henry Ford when he was very old. I shouldn't have done that, but never mind. The child's delight in destroying the father's illusions. It was fabulous. But if we look at the wonder that we had in those sort of inventions, and certainly in my family, that sense of the wonder of mechanical invention and the sort of thing that you can feel in the Industrial Revolution and in the 18th century, and people inventing things. And the internal combustion engine was, of course, later, but it was one of those sort of things. And then I started to think, you know, if you really were B-grade space aliens, say, and you wanted to lay a plan to destroy the planet, maybe the best way you could do it was come to Earth and give people the plans for the internal combustion engine and just go away for 200 years. Because, you know, what this wonderful thing that our family thrived on and whatever, well, you land in any city. You can see it. You don't have to, you know what we're doing to ourselves with our bright, wonderful, poisonous invention. So it's sort of where I started. But you see, by the time the book started, you get to the end of the book and you might see where this started. But when you get to the book, we have an automaton, a mechanical duck at first, which was a real duck from the 18th century that was a bit of a fake because it was meant to, the duck was meant to eat and defecate. Which it did in very fancy houses, I might say, to the amusement of very sophisticated people. And it was a sort of a wonder, you know, and it was. And I thought that this would be the machine, the wondrous machine that I would use to lead finally to these other ideas. And so from there, there's another step, and it's another step, and I think, what's the duck doing? So I have to find the person who wants to have the duck made, and then I have to find the person. These are people I've never met in my life. And then I have to find, and that's all in the 19th century in my book, and then I have to find the woman who in our present day, in our present polluted, overheated world, is going to put this creature back together. That means, I think, oh my God, I've got to know about what it's like to be a horologist working in a museum. I've got to know. I don't know anything about these things. I'm not mechanical at all, but I've got to write the story of a woman who's putting back together an automaton in pieces. And I decide that she has been having an affair for 15 years with somebody she works with, and that it's secret, and no one knows. And he's just died, and she can't even go to the funeral. And I do that because actually I know someone, or of someone that happened to. Awful grief that has to be kept private. And I wasn't thinking when I thought that, how perfect this is, because we're dealing with the human body as a machine, with human life and human death, and things like the automata, which sort of simulates life and is also a machine. So without, I'm trying to, by the end of the book, I hope you'd think I was immensely clever, but I'm also saying at the beginning of it, there's a sort of a way that you have to sort of go into it with a sort of a holy sort of stupidity and not know what you're going to find and not know how you're going to put things together. So as beginning with that other mechanical thing, the glass church, I found not just two people and a love story, but a whole cast of characters who I'd never known and never... No one's anyone I ever saw, really. I'm not writing, but they arrive to serve the needs of the story, and then they have to be real for me, and they can't just be sort of puppets. And so in this case, there's a sort of a triple love story. There's Catherine, who works in the museum, who's putting the automaton together, who's lost her lover. And the bit I'm going to read to you is about her grief and at the very beginning. So I wasn't thinking I was going to write a book like that. People say to me, you've written a book about grief. Well, I guess I have, but it wasn't what I sort of set out to do. It's where the idea led me. And then there's also a relationship between Catherine and the man in the 19th century, long dead, who's going to have the automaton made for his son who has consumption. They never meet. So, you know, this is a sort of insane thing. It's really, you set yourself this sort of difficulty. You say, okay, I'm going to have a story where the two main characters can never meet. You know, am I nuts? My wife thought perhaps I was. So that's a sort of a love story, but in a different way. So Catherine behaves sort of rather badly, but I hope you'll excuse her. She has lost someone she loves. She's English. I'm Australian. I can't do the voice out loud. And, of course, I haven't brought my dress. But here we go. Dead and no one told me. I walked past his office and his assistant was bawling. What is it, Felicia? I asked. Oh, haven't you heard? She said, Mr. Tyndall's dead. What I heard was Mr. Tyndall's hurt his head. I thought, for God's sake, pull yourself together. Where is he, Felicia? That was a reckless thing to ask. Matthew Tyndall and I had been lovers for 13 years, but he was my secret and I was his. In real life, I avoided his assistant. Now her lipstick was smeared and her mouth folded like an ugly sock. Where is he? She sobbed. What an awful, awful question. Not understanding, I asked again. Catherine, he is dead, and thus set herself off into a second fit of bawling. I marched into his office as if to prove her wrong. This was not the sort of thing one did. My secret darling was a big deal, the head curator of metals. There was the photo of his two sons on the desk. His silly, soft tweed hat was lying on the shelf. I snatched it. I don't know why. And of course, she saw me steal it. But I no longer cared. I fled down the Phillips stairs into the main floor. On that April afternoon, in the Georgian halls of the Swinburne Museum, amongst the 1,000 daily visitors, the 80 employees, there was not one single soul who had any idea of what had just happened. Everything looked the same as normal. It was impossible. Matthew was not there waiting to surprise me. He was very distinctive, my lovely. There was a vertical frown mark just to the left of his big, high nose. His hair was thick, his mouth was large, soft, and always tender. And of course, he was married. Of course, of course. He was 40 when I first noticed him, and it was 7 years before we became lovers. I was by then just under 30, and still something of a freak. That is, the first female horologist the museum had ever seen. 13 years, my whole life. It was a beautiful world we lived in all that time. SW1, the Swinburne Museum, one of London's almost secret treasure houses. It had a considerable horological department, a world-famous collection of clocks and watches, automata, and other wind-up engines. If you had been there on the 21st of April, 2010, you may have seen me, the oddly elegant tall woman with the tweed hat scrunched up in her hand. I may have looked mad, but perhaps I was not so different from my colleagues, the various curators and conservators pounding through the public galleries on their way to a meeting or a studio or a storeroom where they would soon interrogate an ancient object, a sword, a quilt, or perhaps an Islamic water clock. We were museum people. Scholars, priests, repairers, sandpaperers, scientists, plumbers, mechanics, train spotters, really, with narrow specialities in metals and glass and textiles and ceramics. We were of all sorts. We insisted, even while we were secretly confident, that the stereotypes held true. A horologist, for instance, could never be a young woman with good legs, but must be a slightly nerdy man of less than 5'6", cautious, a little strange, with fine blonde hair and some difficulty in looking you in the eye. You might see him scurrying like a mouse through the ground floor galleries with his ever-present jangling keys, looking as if he was the keeper of the mysteries. In fact, no one in the Swinburne knew any more than a part of the labyrinth. We had reduced our territories to rat runs. The routes we knew would always take us where we wanted to go. This made it an extraordinarily easy place to live a secret life and to enjoy the perverse pleasure that such a life can give. In death, it was a total horror. That is, the same but brighter, more in focus. Everything was both crisper and further away. How had he died? How could he die? I rushed back to my studio and Googled Matthew Tindall, but there was no news of any accident. However, my inbox had an email which lifted my heart until I realized he had sent it at 4 p.m. the day before. "I kiss your toes." I marked it unread. There was no one I dared turn to. I thought, I will work. It was what I'd always done in crisis. It was what clocks were meant to be good for, their intricacy, their peculiar puzzles. I sat at the bench in the workroom trying to resolve an exceedingly whimsical 18th century French clock. My tools lay on a soft grey chamois. 20 minutes previously, I'd liked this French clock, but now it seemed vain and preening. I buried my nose inside Matthew's hat. "Snuffle," we would have said. "I snuffle you. I snuffle your neck." I could have gone to Sandra, the line manager. She was always a very kind woman, but I could not bear anyone, not even Sandra, handling my private business, putting it out on the table and pushing it round like so many broken necklace beads. "Hello, Sandra. What happened to Mr. Tindall? Do you know?" My German grandfather and my very English father were clockmakers, nothing too spectacular. First Clerkenwell, then the city, then Clerkenwell again. Mostly good, solid English five-wheel clocks. But it was an item of faith for me, even as a little girl, that this was a very soothing, satisfying occupation. For years, I thought, clockmaking must still any turmoil in one's breast. I was so confident of my opinion, and I was so completely wrong. The tea lady provided her depressive offering. I observed the anti-clockwise motion of the slightly curdled milk, just waiting for him, I suppose. So when a hand did touch me, my whole body came unstitched. It felt like Matthew, but Matthew was dead. In his place was Eric Croft, the head curator of horology. I began to howl and could not stop. He was the worst possible witness in the world. Crafty Crofty was, to put it very crudely, the master of all the ticked and tocked. He was a scholar, a historian, a connoisseur. I, in comparison, was a well-educated mechanic. Crofty was famous for his scholarly work on sing-songs, by which is meant those perfect imperial misunderstandings of Oriental culture we so successfully exported to China in the 18th century. Highly elaborate music boxes encased in the most fanciful compositions of exotic beasts and buildings, often placed on elaborate stands. This was what it was like for members of our caste. We built our teetering lives on this sort of thing. The beasts moved their eyes, ears, and tails. Pagodas rose and fell. Jewel stars spun, and revolving glass rods provided a very credible impression of water. I bawled and bawled, and now I was the one whose mouth looked like a sock puppet. Like a large chairman of a rugger club who has a chichawa as a pet, Eric did not at all resemble his sing-songs, which one might expect to be the passion of a slim, fastidious homosexual. He had instead a sort of hetero, gung-ho quality metals people are meant to have. "No," he cried. "Hush." "Hush." He was not rough with me, but he got his big, hard arm around my shoulder and compelled me into the fume cupboard and then turned on the extractor fan, which roared like 20 hairdryers all at once. I thought, I've let the cat out of the bag. "No," he said, "don't." The cupboard was awfully small, built solely so that one conservator might clean an ancient object with toxic solvent. He was stroking my shoulder as if I were a horse. "We will look after you," he said. In the midst of bawling, I finally understood that Crofty knew my secret, after all. "Go home for now," he said quietly. I thought, I've betrayed us. I thought Matthew will be pissed. "Meet me at the Greasy Spoon," he said. 10 o'clock tomorrow, across the road from the annex. Do you think you can manage that? Do you mind?" "Yes," I said, thinking, "so that's it. They're going to kick me out of the main museum. They're going to lock me in the annex." I'd spilled the beans. "Good." He beamed, and the creases around his mouth gave him a rather cat-like appearance. He turned off the extractor fan, and suddenly I could smell his aftershave. "First we'll get you sick leave. We'll get through this together. I've got something for you to start sort out," he said. "A really lovely object." That was how people talk at the Swinburne. They say object instead of clock. I thought, he is exiling me, burying me. The annex was situated behind Olympia, where my grief might be as private as my love. So he was being kind to me. Strange, macho, Crofty. I kissed him on his rough, sandalwood-smelling cheek. We both looked at each other with astonishment, and then I fled out onto the humid street, pounding down towards the Albert Hall with Matthew's lovely, silly hat crushed inside my hand. Yes! Well, it was 23 minutes and something. That's not so bad. That's not so bad. Don't you hate sitting in the seat while someone drones on? I do. We can have some sort of attempt at conversation now, if we'd like. Yes. Well, I have a very good smart-ass answer to the question, which is, why did you come to New York? I came to New York for the waters. And whereupon those who know Casablanca will say, but there are no waters in New York, where I then say I was misinformed. But I came to New York like I'd done so many things in my life, you know, sort of by accident. I was married to somebody at that stage who really wanted to live in New York, and I thought, why not? And I didn't really expect to be living here 22 years later and to have two American children and a different English wife. So I'm here. And you know, the English wife doesn't seem like she wants to run a publishing company in Australia, and my two sons seem very American to me. So we're all sort of here, jumbled up together. And in that period of time, not having come because it was good for my career, because I thought really it was probably a rather silly or dangerous sort of a thing to do, to remove myself from Australia. But in the end, I think that what we have to follow our lives and then do, make the work one does as a response. So I don't know whether it's better or worse, except I'm here. Yes, soul to the woman in the front row.
So, tell us how you approach male and female characters differently.
I normally come at the women from the front. I don't really... The question of male and female characters is people... If you're thinking about any character, you've really just got to really think about what affects this person. What are the situations in that will enable them or limit them? What, you know, if you're writing about a character who's living in a ticket booth at a movie house, then if that's where they've got to live, everything they do is constrained by that. So, if you're writing about men and women, each of them will have sort of constraints and things that affect the way they're thinking. You know, if a woman is going to do that, what will that mean? What will she think? And everything. I don't really, really, really think about it very much. And I think if I went on for another 10 minutes, say, I could probably get myself into a really embarrassing corner. So I won't. Yes? Oh, okay, I'll repeat from now on. I can't remember the old questions. They've all gone. But I'll repeat the new questions. I'm sorry for not doing that.
I just wanted to ask you something more about your schedule. You finished this book, and I assume you're doing readings about the country or perhaps overseas. But do you write after? Do you take a break? Or do you just sort of wait for another thought to come? Or do you actually sort of lock yourself up
Okay. Okay. Remember, I've got to encapsulate this question. This is demanding. So the question really is partly begins at being about my schedule, but then more particularly about what happens. You know, like I finished a book, I go to promote it. When am I going to start writing another book? Am I like someone painting a bridge, never stopping, because it just has to continue? There's a certain stage, I think, with almost every book where I think I will never write another book again, and I think I have no idea what I will do next. And that probably happens towards the last 6 months of writing a book. But because I'm worried about it, I do start to sort of think about it. So I'm thinking about two things at once at that stage. And I will, normally, something will come along that I'll think, that's sort of interesting. And then, you know, when you finish a book, it doesn't all happen at once. So, there are so many different stages and so many blank bits. There's a bit, you know, where it goes to your editor who then decides to go to India for, you know, a while. And then and there's all these sort of things like, you know, the English want to say something, the Australians want to say something, well, shut up. But anyway, and the cover has to be designed and the proofs have to be done. In all those periods, there's weeks and weeks and weeks between things that happen. And I tend to start thinking about things or just reading around things. And with a bit of luck, by the time I actually finally have to go on the road and drone on, which I'm not doing, and this has got nothing to do I just came because Ada asked me to come. But it's not got anything really to do with that process. By the time I'm doing that, with a bit of luck, I've got sort of 50 pages or 60 pages. And so when the reading tour is over and you recognise the fundamental sort of uselessness and depressing nature of what you've just been engaged in, then at least you've got a book to come back to. And you know that that's really what it's about. And it's not, the other thing will never be what you, you know, when I was younger, particularly, you sort of go on a book tour, you know, and think, oh, and everything was going to change. But of course, nothing changes. It's okay. Please, a question. How do I arrive at names for my characters? Rather carelessly, I think. I mean, I think in the case of, well, I think looking back at Oscar and Lucinda, which is Oscar's a very, very strange English name. I mean, really. So how did this person get to be called Oscar? Well, I sort of explained it away, but really I think it's because of Oscar and the Tin Drum, really. Although I didn't admit that to myself at the time, that this was a book. Gunter Grass's book was a book I loved, and probably that's why I wanted to call the character Oscar. But I called the female character Hermione, and that's what she was called all the way through the book. And then when I got to the end of it, I thought, I'm going to be doing these interviews. And they're going to say, you know, I'm going to say, Oscar and Hermione. And, or, you know, I'm going to, it's going to be really hard for me to say, and it's going to be embarrassing. So I spent weeks thinking about what would be a sort of Victorian name that would also sort of feel in some way modern, which is sort of what, you know, the book wants to feel modern too. And I thought Lucinda was a beautiful name and was perfect before I really started to think about light or glass or any of those sorts of associations. So there's and sometimes, like, there's a character called which after Oscar and Lucinda, which is a 19th century book, I was determined to write a modern book. And so it's set in the western suburbs of Sydney, you know, in contemporary times. But my head was full of all the great chances I'd had for English names in Oscar and Lucinda, and I felt I'd done really badly. And so you find a character in the modern book called Catch Price, which would have been a perfect 19th century sort of name. And so, but this sort of come from, it's an expression of my regret that I hadn't done better with the earlier book. So, yes. No, I haven't really. The question was about, I've written non-fiction and fiction. Well, I've been accused of writing non-fiction, but really, I can't lie straight in bed. As we say. So, I mean, I really admire journalists so much who really have to really respect what really, really happened and give it form and write it beautifully, and I can't do that. And so the book I said in Sydney is called 30 Days in Sydney, but it's also called A Wildly Distorted Account, which it is. I went with my son to Japan, in which it was necessary for me to invent a character. And somehow along the way, that the fact of that invention, to my great distress in this country, was sort of overlooked. And I suddenly discovered my book was published as a memoir. And although it's sort of essentially true as anything ever is, there's a whole character there that's invented. And so when it had come out and I was on the road promoting it, I was so guilty and embarrassed, I couldn't stand it. My mouth was saying, I made it up, because I think there's a really important relationship of trust between the writer and the reader. And it's fine if you make stuff up, but if you say that you're trying to tell the truth, then it's very bad to make things up. So that's a little bit of a slip up there. Did I write the film script for Oscar and Lucinda? Well, you've answered your own question, really. You said you loved the movie. Clearly, I didn't write it. Well, it's not for me to like or dislike, really. I mean, I wrote a novel. I hope the novel will sustain itself. Gillian Armstrong, the director, I'd known all my grown-up life. The people who did it were doing it with agents who didn't want them to do this Australian arty film. They all did it because they loved the book. They were courageous in all sorts of ways. And I couldn't ask for anything more than that. I mean, I expect them to... It's not mine. And I used to, we, Gillian and I occasionally, before the film came out, would be called to do interviews. And they'd say, well, what do you think about Gillian doing your film? And I'd say, well, you know, when I began the book, I had the right to fail, so I give her the right to fail. And Gillian would say, and the right to succeed, too. So my opinion doesn't matter, really. It's not mine. And I admire the people who did it very, very much. And I think that's they had courage, and that's all. So I'm inevitably not going to like it because it's not what I imagined. And it can't be what I imagined. It couldn't possibly be. So, and I never really expected it would be. So, yeah, great, great actors. I mean, that was Kate Blanchett's second film, I think. And Rafe, yeah, absolutely. No, great, great, great actors. And the director, Gillian, there's a long history of, you know, I mean, Judy Davis had her first role in a film by Gillian Armstrong. And she's a fabulous director with very, very good feeling for actors. So this is not to take anything away from the film. It's just to be, just to sort of confess to you completely about my defects as a person. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, one here and then one behind. Well, the question is, it felt like a very quiet novel, The Chemistry of Tears, and you know, which was said in a nice supportive way, did it feel like that to me? Well, you know, I've always found the apocalypse really soothing. I know what you mean when you say that, and of course I don't know how to look at it. It's very hard to look at your own book. I mean, one of the most important things, you know, as Ada said, I teach creative writing in the MFA program at Hunter, and there it's very hard to get into. The numbers are a little even steeper than you said in fiction. You know, we have for six places we're looking at nearly 500 applicants now. Oh, well, good. Well, there you go. And so they're really smart and they're driven, but they still have to learn to be writers. But they're really... And so when you have a classroom, the students will wish to be prescriptive, which is only natural because they'll have opinions. But the real genius of the workshop is that the writer has the benefit of 11 other really good readers and understanding how what the writer's done is being read. That is, this is not something that's easily accessible to the writer alone to understand how their work is read. So when you say that to me now, and I think, well, that's probably true. How was I thinking about it? I think I was more concerned with all of the risks I was taking and whether I could get people to accept that sometimes sort of, you know, sort of chancy sort of notions that are in the book. But, you know, if it's quiet, that's good. That's, it would certainly be, you know, in all of us, everything one writes, one wants to escape one's own character. So quiet would be good for me. Yes. So the question is about me writing screenplays based on my books, and with the final observation that perhaps I wasn't allowed to do them. No, but I think I should not be allowed to do them. I think I think that's quite correct. I've been involved in one way or another with three movies, Oscar and Lucinda, which... See, I don't think they even asked me to do it, but I think I say that I didn't want to do it. But I don't believe I was asked, but I was very happy with what they were doing. I was very involved with a film which now I'm not... I don't encourage anyone to watch, which is a novel based on a novel, a movie based on Bliss, a novel of mine, which sort of embarrasses me in many ways now, in ways that the book might not, but I haven't looked at the book, so maybe the book would too. And I was ridiculously confident writing it. You know, I mean, it didn't occur to me for a second that I really knew nothing about dramatic art at all, and that actually maybe I was not the best person to be doing this. And basically the film ended with the director and I getting into a squabble because I'd put his name first, not knowing that that meant something. So it's got a history. And then I worked with Wim Wenders on a film called Until the End of the World, which is a very good title, describes it in many ways, which in the end was Wim's film. He had lunch with me in about 1985 and took 3 hours to tell me the story of the film, and I thought, doesn't he know? And then at the end of about, you know, what, another 2 years' work or whatever it was, Wim just went back to do what he'd always wanted to do, you know, that's what it is. So that's his film. We had some very good wine along the way. Sometimes flew first, normally business. It was quite enjoyable. I met some nice people. But no, I don't want to do movies anymore. And there's not a big queue outside my door of people asking me to either. So I'm lucky. Yes? Well, certainly one can never give them talent. So that, and then one can't give them will. And they seem to me to be two of the most important ingredients. But by the time, you know, you've sort of looked at for finding, in our fortunate position, 6 people out of 500, you can actually see that there are people who've got stuff they want to write about, and you can see that the people do have talent. And you learn to recognize that will, sheer will, is really, really important. After that, I think that what we do is often, like, would depend whether you thought an editor can offer something or not. And if an editor can offer nothing, then you can't teach writing. And if an editor can offer something, then you can. Like that. Oh yes, that's why it's fun, but also I think there's a really interesting. Have you perhaps ever taught creative writing, sir?
I've taught it for many years.
Thought you might have. So I'll tell you what. You can visit my class, and I'll visit yours, and there are all sorts of problems with it. I encourage and hope that we can have a class to be very crude, that doesn't have bullshit, where people manage to be respectful of each other. And I have never had classes at... I taught at NYU and Columbia and Princeton and Barnard and the New School. I've never had students like we have here, because I only have to get 6 a year. And I think it's fun to come. If you'd like to come to the class, please come. But I knew you would. Well, could I ask you interrupt to ask how young you call young? Yeah, well, the younger ones are sort of normally very difficult. I'm much in favour of the 28 and 33-year-old. However, there are people in my workshop who are in their early 20s, but they have to be really good to get there. Sorry?
The main thing is that you think
Well, I always go to class totally drunk, you see. It's that makes everything very pleasant. Do we have any other questions? Yes, up the back, sorry. And then over there. Here. Oh, well, okay, we'll do it the other way around. Not a quiet book. Would I like to talk about the bizarre characters in Germany? Well, you know, it's always... Well, sorry, you want to expand on that? I needed... One of the characters I had to invent was going to be a clockmaker, and I really ended up thinking of him like a sort of... Well, he's a sort of at once a sort of a follower of a master, but he's also a mad megalomaniac artist. He's the sort of person. He's the sort of person. If he was an architect, you would go to him and you would say, you know, I want this and I want this and I want this. And by the time you're finished, he's built you, you know, a cathedral in your backyard and a doghouse at the front, and that's what you're going to have. And he's not going to apologize because he's a great man. And so, I really love the character. I mean, he's. I'll tell you who he reminds me of a little bit, who I must have drawn from. What's that Italian artist's name? Benvenuto Cellini. Have you ever read his book? Sort of, there's something about his character that is so willful and mad and scheming and it's great. So I just wanted somebody a little bit like that. So that's, I think I might have stolen a little bit from that. So and I like people like that. And I'm always told, why do I have such sort of outsiders or such peculiar people? Well, you know, they don't seem peculiar to me. That's the terrible truth. That's the admission. Yes.
So you mentioned risk a little while ago. Could you talk about a specific risk that was of concern to you and how you ended up to gauging that risk and how far to take it?
Well, I thought... Well, one of the risks in this novel, you know, you have two characters who can never meet. And because one's living in 2010 and the other's living in 1854. And I didn't really know. I mean, in the end, it's really totally obvious how it can work, but it wasn't obvious to me. And so I set off into this thing sort of really... thinking this was a slightly risky venture because I didn't know how to solve it, and I sort of plowed ahead. And in the end, there's a number of things that happen, but one of the things that happens is because one of the people is having an object constructed and the other person is reconstructing it, you can sort of get these things meshing together in an emotional and in terms of argument as well. And so they do feel connected, and they feel emotionally connected as well as thematically connected. And then there is the other thing is that one of them, Catherine, is reading the 19th century figure's notebooks. And what I got into, which I think finally, you know, really I hope works, is that you have that relationship between the reader and the writer, which is very intense and I think I used that to bring that off. And there's probably other things that I don't even know that I did. But I did think I was just pig-headed that it could work, but I didn't know how to work. And I think whether it was a real difficulty that somebody else could have easily have seen how to fix or... Anyway, I was frightened. It's good. It's nervous. Makes the adrenaline run a little bit. Yeah. Oh, I think so. Could I say anything about what I'm working on now? Well, I probably could, but I'd be sorry later, I suppose. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
thank you all for coming, and certainly thank Mr. Carey for a wonderful evening. We have books for sale outside. The Corner Bookstore are here, and Mr. Carey will be happy to sign his new book. And if you have brought your own books as well, I'm sure he'll be happy to sign for you. I just wanted to put in a plug for a couple of our upcoming events. We have an exciting event next week with Joseph Cannon, who is going to be here for the first time in our library on Tuesday, October the 2nd at 6:30. And we have a jazz evening in a couple of weeks with a great singer by the name of Nancy Harrow with guitar player Jack Wilkins. And this room will become a jazz club for the evening. That's Wednesday, October 10th at 6:30. So thank you all for coming. And thanks once again to Peter Carey.